Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take the crucial stories and complex analyses and distill them down into essential knowledge. We are undertaking a thorough, comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed report of the day's critical news.
And we are diving deep into the pages of the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, November 29th, 2025.
I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and joining me to unpack all this material is Sam Astor.
Alex, it's great to be here. Our mission, as always, is to give you, our listener, a complete, rigorous overview of every single article, really focusing on the immediate impact and, you know, the long-term implications.
And the narrative today is, it's just full of these extreme contradictions.
Absolutely.
Our initial snapshot shows major market indices soaring, right? They're propelled by investor optimism flirting with record highs.
Right.
But at the same time, the physical and digital systems that actually underpin global finance are showing some alarming fragility.
A huge disconnect.
Then we've got geopolitical crises intensifying. I mean, the biggest shakeup in Ukraine's government since the war started. And that's paired with this rapid, profound shift in U.S. domestic policy, especially around immigration.
And we cap it all off with something a little different. The surprisingly reflective culture of American wealth meeting the budget-conscious reality of what's being called the leftover Olympics.
It really is a study in global cognitive dissonance. You have this high-altitude euphoria of financial predictions running directly into these, you know, ground-level mechanical failures that keep the whole system running.
A perfect way to put it. So let's start with that market euphoria, because the late November rally is certainly providing some dramatic reading.
Okay, so stocks are moving near record highs. They've basically reversed a slump we saw just earlier in the month. What is the single biggest engine driving this comeback?
It's anticipation, pure and simple. Investors are now aggressively, and I mean aggressively, betting on the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates in December.
Okay, so they're front-running the Fed's decision.
Totally. Per the CME FedWatch tool, the probability of a rate cut has doubled over the past few weeks. It's now sitting at around 87%. Yeah. That anticipation is, it's the market's fuel right now.
Let's get into the indexes, because November was definitely a story of winners and losers, wasn't it?
It really was. The broader market was thin but positive. The S&P 500 rose about 0.5% on Friday,
which brought it close to that record set back in October.
Exactly. It eked out a 0.1% monthly gain. Then you have the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which advanced 0.6% on Friday. That secured a 0.3% monthly gain.
And that's its longest winning streak since early 2018, I read.
It is. And that's a powerful sign, you know, of some underlying stability for those industrial giants.
But the tech-heavy NASDAQ, that tells a very different story.
A completely different story. It registered its first monthly loss since March, down 1.5%. That suggests the excitement around tech wasn't quite universal.
So what's behind that?
Well, that loss was spurred by a really choppy period. It was fueled by fears of an artificial intelligence bubble, you know, maybe a correction coming.
Right.
And even though it added 0.7% on Friday, bolstered by chip stocks like Intel and analog devices, and the big hitters like Amazon and Meta, there are just clear signs of sensitivity.
And what about the darling of the AI boom, NVIDIA?
Even NVIDIA, the stock that has defined this whole thing, dropped 1.8% on Friday. That capped a pretty rocky month for that specific company.
So if the NASDAQ is showing volatility and even a giant like NVIDIA is sensitive, it feels like the market is just desperately hunting for stability.
And it's found them in that Fed signal. We are talking about traders nearly doubling their bets on a rate cut.
Logistically, though, a quarter point reduction isn't. I mean, it's not huge. What's the real impact here?
The value of the cut is almost entirely psychological and systemic. It's not the 25 basis points itself.
It's the signal.
It's the important signaling value that the Fed recognizes a softening labor market and is prepared to act before a recession really hits. It suggests a dovish pivot, a move toward easing, which investors just interpret as a green light for more growth.
Okay, but here's where we need to apply some critical thinking. If the market optimism is based entirely on the expectation of a cut, isn't there a risk of a dangerous feedback loop?
That is precisely the risk.
Is the market now driving the Fed's decision instead of the Fed driving the economy?
You've hit the nail on the head. If the Fed caves to market pressure, which that 87% betting on certainly represents, it suggests investor euphoria might be overriding genuine economic data.
And what if they don't cut?
Well, if they don't cut, the market could see that as a catastrophic failure of communication. Or worse, a sign that the Fed knows something awful that the market doesn't. And that could lead to a sharp, violent correction. This reliance on signaling, it just makes the market profoundly fragile right now.
And while all that was going on with stocks, the commodity and crypto spaces, they just went into overdrive.
Oh, absolutely. Silver hit an all-time record high. It topped $56 per troy ounce. That's almost double its value this year.
Incredible. And gold and Bitcoin.
Gold rallied and Bitcoin soared past $92,000.
So what does that movement suggest? It feels like a flight to something.
It suggests deep underlying global anxieties. Investors are looking for genuine storehouses of value. The massive surge in silver and gold in particular that speaks to inflation hedging, to geopolitical flux.
And Bitcoin.
Bitcoin topping 92,000. That reflects both a risk-on sentiment and, you know, a continued flight from traditional fiat currencies. It's a clear sign that people are looking for high-octane growth outside of stocks.
Okay, now let's pivot from these soaring, almost abstract asset values to the very physical reality of the systems that trade them. Because this is where that fragility was exposed, and I mean dramatically.
Yes.
We have to talk about the CME Group outage.
This is truly fascinating because it operates as this profound metaphor for the entire digital economy. We're talking about a 10-hour outage in the trading of equity, bond, and commodity futures.
The derivatives tied to trillions of dollars.
Trillions.
And what brought this massive, sophisticated global system to its knees? It wasn't a hacker. It wasn't some algorithmic failure. It was simple.
It was so simple. It was a failure of physical infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
An environmental failure at a vital data center in Aurora, Illinois, run by Cyrusone.
What happened?
The complex chiller plant failed. The air conditioning. So temperatures inside the facility just soared toward 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Which is way too hot for servers.
Way too hot. Data centers need to be kept cool, ideally in the 64 to 81 degree range to prevent a total meltdown. The fact that the most advanced financial systems in the world depend on boring old air conditioning, it just highlights this critical vulnerability.
And the CME handles, what, the lion's share of U.S. futures volume?
Pretty much all of it. So when this happened, trading was just slammed from late Thanksgiving right up until an hour before Wall Street opened. The key takeaway here isn't just that a machine failed. It's that futures trading, unlike stock trading, is highly, highly centralized.
That's the high-level insight we need to focus on.
It is. Stock exchanges are spread out. You have NYSE, NASDAQ, and several others. There's redundancy.
But not for futures.
No. The U.S. futures market is dominated by CME. This concentration creates a single point of failure. If the AC fails in Aurora, Illinois, the ripple effects hit derivatives tied to $9.6 trillion in interest rate bets globally.
And the mitigation failed, too. I mean, why didn't they just switch over to their backup center in New York? Isn't that what it's for?
That's the critical failure in preparation. Sources are suggesting that many large trading firms, the key players who provide liquidity on CME, they lacked robust technical infrastructure set up at the New York backup site.
You're kidding?
Nope. They preferred the simplicity of just waiting out the 10-hour outage in Illinois, which was a known problem, rather than dealing with the complexity and the cost of switching all their systems and algorithms to an untested backup environment.
So we have two layers of vulnerability. First, the market is all concentrated at CME.
Right.
And second, there's this massive collective action problem where the key users of the exchange just failed to prepare for the backup.
It makes the whole digital infrastructure feel much more like a fragile utility than the robust, always-on network we kind of believe it to be.
And I imagine competitors are loving this.
Oh, of course. This gives ammunition to competitors like FMX, an upstart exchange that's challenging CME's dominance. They were quick to point out that this is exactly why more competition and alternatives are needed. The smoothness of modern finance relies on machines staying cool. It's a surprisingly brittle dependency.
That's a perfect bridge to looking at the future, because despite this immediate fragility, the long-term outlook for corporate deal-making seems to suggest confidence is returning. There's a Deloitte survey.
Yes, and this forecast is critical because M&A activity is a key barometer of corporate confidence. It predicts a rise in the number of transactions in 2026.
So not just the value, but the volume of deals.
Exactly. Deal value rebounded earlier this year, but the volume, the number of deals, has been suppressed by all this economic uncertainty and high borrowing costs.
So what does a rise in transaction numbers tell us?
It means executives clearly believe that capital and credit markets are going to remain accommodative, a bet that aligns perfectly with those rate cut predictions we just discussed. It means companies are more willing to engage in smaller, more strategic deals, which indicates confidence in their ability to integrate and profit from acquisitions.
It suggests executives are looking past the immediate volatility and betting on a stable environment 2 years from now. It's a measure of optimism that just contrasts so sharply with the immediate technical chaos we just described.
Let's shift our attention now to global instability, and we have to start with the biggest political earthquake to hit Kyiv since the war began.
The Ukraine corruption shakeup.
Yes, and the resignation of Andriy Yermak, President Zelensky's top aide and his principal peace negotiator.
This is a massive blow. Yermak was, he was an indispensable, trusted figure. He was the one Western officials went to for everything.
He was. And his departure leaves Zelensky without a key emissary at the exact moment Russia is advancing and the U.S. is pressuring Kyiv for concessions.
And the scandal itself is deeply troubling. What's the core of it?
The investigation focuses on a $100 million kickback scheme at Energoatom, the state nuclear energy company.
$100 million.
Officials allegedly demanded kickbacks from contractors before they'd get paid, which drove up electricity prices. So Ukrainian citizens were the primary victims here.
And while neither Yermak nor Zelensky has been formally accused.
No, they haven't. But the investigation widened significantly enough to necessitate Yermak's resignation after anti-corruption investigators actually searched his home.
Yermak was often criticized internally, wasn't he, for accumulating too much power, seen as this operator with his hands in everything.
He was. But he also played this crucial international role. He successfully pushed back against the Trump administration's initial 28-point roadmap to end the war, which many Ukrainians saw as alarmingly pro-Russian.
So what's fascinating here, according to the analysis in the journal, is this paradoxical implication of the whole probe.
Right. While corruption obviously exists, Ukraine is 105th on Transparency International's index, which, by the way, is a big improvement from 144th in 2013.
That's a huge jump.
It is. The fact that the anti-corruption institutions are operating independently and aggressively, even against the most powerful men in the country during wartime, that's a sign that those institutions are finally working.
But here's the critical point, especially for listeners in Washington. Anti-Ukraine voices in the U.S. are quick to seize on this exact corruption as an excuse to pull funding and abandon aid.
And this is where we really need to apply some critical analysis. While accountability is vital, using zero tolerance for corruption as the standard for U.S. support is, while it's highly disingenuous, the source material makes this point explicitly. The U.S. president is reportedly ready to propose more business deals with Russia, one of the world's most corrupt nations. The administration has previously told Saudi officials they don't care how the House of Saud rules their country internally.
So if the U.S. is willing to work with far more unsavory regimes when it suits its interests,
right,
then setting an impossibly high transparent standard for Ukraine, a democracy fighting for its survival, it becomes less about integrity and more about providing political cover to abandon a costly ally, doesn't it?
Precisely. If support is judged solely by internal corruption standards, the U.S. would have very few allies left. The strategic assessment has to ultimately weigh American national security interests against the internal governance of the partner state.
And the conclusion is?
The conclusion is that the existence of the probe should actually be viewed as evidence of a functioning state trying to reform, not just as proof of endemic corruption.
This uncertainty hangs so heavily over Europe, where leaders are experiencing this profound sense of anxiety, fearing they have reached the point of becoming a global also-ran.
Yeah, left behind by the U.S., China, and Russia.
And that mood has darkened significantly over the last year.
It has. European leaders felt particularly sidelined by two specific events. First, an unfavorable trade deal with the U.S. in July that saw Europe give up more than it received.
Okay.
And second, the profound shock when the White House presented a Ukraine ceasefire plan without even consulting European leaders. That signaled they were just bystanders in decisions that directly affect their own continental security.
They feel they're no longer masters of their own destiny, too reliant on these transactional relationships with Washington. So what is their planned response to this perceived decline?
The EU is rushing to rearm and break decades of institutional gridlock. Mario Draghi, the former ECB president, he's leading the charge.
What's he pushing for?
He's pushing for pan-European initiatives, joint defense research, pooled procurement, and massive pooled investments in strategic sectors like semiconductors. It's a recognition that they have to achieve strategic autonomy, both militarily and economically.
And Germany, which has historically been the anchor of European economic constraint, is being forced to make some fundamental shifts.
Monumental shifts. They've had to ease their famous debt brake due to three factors: the loss of cheap Russian gas, shifting export markets in China, and, you know, the necessity of shoring up their own defense.
They're spending big.
Berlin is committing 500 billion euros to a rearmament program. They finally understand that relying on U.S. defense, coupled with the U.S.'s increasingly transactional approach, using security leverage to win economic clashes, is just no longer tenable.
So Europe is realizing the hard way that its wealthy single market, which they once thought gave them unassailable trade clout,
didn't protect them from Washington's political maneuvering.
And the ripple effects of this instability extend to the Middle East, where tensions just continue to mount.
Yeah.
We have a deepening Israel-Syria rift.
Yes, a deadly Israeli military raid in Beit Jinn, southern Syria, led to significant clashes. Syrian media reported 13 fatalities, and Israel confirmed 6 of its soldiers were wounded.
And this incident deepens the rift with the new Syrian government.
Significantly. Since the collapse of the Assad regime, Israel has been aggressively carving out these buffer zones, occupying about 155 square miles, and Damascus considers those actions a severe violation of their sovereignty, a provocation.
And there's also a critical domestic inquiry in the West Bank that touches on the fundamental rules of engagement for Israeli security forces.
Yes. Israeli authorities are reviewing the conduct of forces who shot 2 members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad during an operation in Jenin.
And this was triggered by video footage.
That's right. The review was triggered by video footage that appeared to show the men surrendering, hands raised, shirts lifted to show they were unarmed, before they were shot at close range.
And the political reaction was?
Immediate and polarized. National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir fully backed the forces, stating, quote, "Terrorists must die." This incident and the political defense of the action, it just underscores the intense, high-stakes debate over ethics and security policy within the current government.
Shifting east again, the dilemma over Taiwan and the U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity continues to challenge stability in Asia.
Right. For decades, this ambiguity leaving the U.S. response intentionally vague, it successfully deterred Beijing. But China's military growth is making that vagueness feel dangerously outdated.
Especially when China's leader Xi Jinping recently emphasized to President Trump that Taiwan must return to the mainland.
And Trump's subsequent public silence on defending the democracy is deeply unnerving to regional allies, given his history of withdrawing security guarantees.
Yet Taiwan's leadership seems outwardly confident. President Lai Ching-te declared the U.S. relationship rock solid.
And he's backing that up with a massive $40 billion special budget for military spending to bolster their own deterrence.
So is that confidence real, or is it political theater?
It's a mix of both. There's genuine, deep-level cooperation with the U.S. military that continues unabated, regardless of presidential tweets. But they also need to show their own population in Beijing that they are proactively defending themselves. They're using their financial power to buy military certainty where political certainty is lacking.
That focus on military preparedness brings us right back to our recurring theme of systemic fragility, specifically in defense tech, with the setbacks at Anduril Industries.
Ah, yes, Anduril. The company valued at over $30 billion that promised to revolutionize autonomous warfare with software like Lattice.
They represent that Silicon Valley model, right? Move fast, break things.
Exactly. Move fast, iterate constantly, and fail often. They argue this is how you beat the traditional defense contractors. But the failures are proving expensive and, frankly, operationally embarrassing in real-world military exercises.
So let's synthesize these setbacks. What's the common thread here?
The common thread is the massive gap between software complexity and unforgiving physical engineering reality.
Like with the drone boats.
Take the drone boats. In a Navy exercise, over a dozen of them, all reliant on Anduril's Lattice autonomy software, failed. They rejected inputs, automatically idled, and just became dead in the water.
And Navy personnel had to scramble overnight to retrieve them.
They did. That software, which was designed to orchestrate these complex machine-to-machine tasks at speeds beyond human capacity, it failed at basic boat navigation, and the official reports were highly critical.
Then there was the Fury unmanned jet fighter prototype.
Another one. Its first flight was delayed by 2 months compared to its competitor, General Atomics, because a nail, a simple piece of construction material, was sucked into the engine intake during a ground test. A tiny piece of physical debris brought a cutting-edge jet project to a halt.
And finally, the Anduril counter-drone system that crashed and caused a fire.
A 22-acre fire in Oregon. This points to insufficient mitigation and testing protocols. Traditional defense contractors spend decades testing precisely to prevent these kinds of catastrophic failures.
And Anduril's response is that this is the cost of rapid testing.
That's their line. But when failing often involves fire, expensive hardware, and threats to national defense, the Silicon Valley ethos suddenly feels recklessly unprepared. The critical insight here is that when the stakes involve national security, speed just cannot come at the expense of fundamental, predictable reliability.
That distinction is vital. Let's carry that understanding of fragility and high stakes into our next section on U.S. domestic politics.
The immigration debate has just intensified dramatically, and it was fueled by a tragic catalyst.
The fatal shooting of National Guard Specialist Sarah Beckstrom, who was only 20, in D.C.
And she was shot by an Afghan national who had been granted asylum.
The political response from the White House was immediate and intense. President Trump intensified his push for a reverse migration agenda, publicly stating only reverse migration can fully cure this situation.
And this wasn't just talk. It translated instantly into sweeping policy changes. The Department of Homeland Security immediately and indefinitely stopped processing all immigration requests from Afghanistan.
And the restrictions expanded.
They expanded to 19 high-risk countries, making citizenship from those nations a significantly negative factor for a green card application.
And crucially, USCIS halted all asylum decisions.
All of them, stating that every applicant must now be vetted and screened to the maximum degree possible. This is a massive administrative slowdown that affects hundreds of thousands of people already in the system.
It's an explicit challenge to the existing legal immigration framework based on national origin. But the story of Specialist Sarah Beckstrom provides a really poignant counterpoint to this top-down policy shift.
It does. She was from Webster Springs, West Virginia, a tiny community defined by fierce bonds, a tradition of military service, and, frankly, a scarcity of local jobs.
She joined the Guard and also worked a second job as a community behavioral health specialist.
Her choice of professions really speaks volumes. Her CEO noted that both joining the Guard and working in behavioral health are helping professions. She was driven by her heart and not because of her pocketbook.
Just trying to build a meaningful life in a community with limited economic opportunity. Her background gives this human weight to the whole national conversation.
It really does.
We're also seeing the current administration targeting the actions of the prior one. Specifically, President Trump announcing he's revoking all executive orders signed by former President Joe Biden using an auto pen, alleging it's illegal.
This is a primarily political theater. It's escalating a long-running Republican scrutiny of Biden's auto pen use. But while presidents are legally allowed to undo their predecessors' executive orders, the interesting legal battle here concerns clemency, pardons and commutations.
Right, because legal scholars question whether you can actually undo clemency once it has been formally granted. How does the auto pen factor into that?
Well, the legality hinges on one core distinction. Did Biden delegate the signature, which the G.W. Bush Justice Department approved, provided the president still made the decision, or did he delegate the decision to sign?
And Trump is claiming?
Trump is claiming Biden was entirely uninvolved in the auto pen process. If that could be successfully proven, it could invalidate the order. This sets up a fascinating and complex legal fight over the legitimacy of past presidential actions.
Okay, moving away from Washington, let's look at a fascinating case study in political success within a deeply red state. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear.
Yes, he continues to win repeatedly in a state that Trump won by 30 points in 2024.
How does he do it?
Beshear has mastered the art of positioning himself as the common sense, common ground Democrat. His communication style is particularly effective. He explicitly criticizes some national Democrats for using what he calls advocacy speak.
Like what?
Phrases like justice-involved population instead of inmates, or substance use disorder instead of addiction.
He urges them conversationally to just speak like normal human beings.
That is a crucial strategic choice. It's designed to cut through jargon and connect with working-class voters outside the party's coastal, identity-focused base. And while his legislative record is liberal, he pushed for medical marijuana and sports betting, his image remains moderate.
And he's weighing a 2028 presidential bid.
He is. And he argues the party should focus 80% of its time on things that matter to 100% of people, specifically financial stability, claiming everyone is struggling to pay the bills.
His challenge on a national stage will be immense, though.
Absolutely. Navigating a primary process that often punishes moderation. But his success in Trump country provides a potential blueprint for Democrats looking to rebuild viability in the Midwest and South.
That blueprint stands in stark contrast to the self-inflicted policy crises unfolding in many progressive-led states.
Where ambitious climate dreams are colliding hard with energy reality, blue states are facing increasing electricity rates and declining reliability due to the rapid, often forced transition away from traditional power sources.
We're seeing some attempts at moderation driven by electoral concerns.
We are. New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill won partly by pledging to deal with high electricity costs. California Governor Gavin Newsom is moderating some positions ahead of a potential 2028 bid, like returning billions to ratepayers, though he's careful to deflect blame.
But the situation in Massachusetts provides the most damning example of policy just be disconnected from practical reality.
Governor Morhealy is facing real embarrassment after videos showed her blocking natural gas infrastructure that she now says the state desperately needs to avert power shortages.
And this is a direct consequence of her prior activism, right?
Right. It is. As Attorney General, she received a significant $300,000 grant from the Barr Foundation, a climate activist organization, to fund a study. She then used that study to successfully challenge a regulator's order allowing new gas pipelines, a victory she proudly boasted about at the time.
And now?
Now, the state grid operator is warning of potential power shortages this winter, confirming that solar and wind simply won't deliver sufficient, reliable power yet. But despite this practical crisis, the political resistance remains overwhelming.
They blocked a vote to change the climate mandate.
They did. Efforts in the State House to change the ambitious 2030 climate mandate from mandatory to aspirational were blocked. It just highlights this profound problem. When political figures become too invested in the activist world, they lose sight of the necessary engineering and economic realities of energy production.
A reminder that even the bluest states are not immune to the fundamental laws of physics and economics.
Precisely. Let's transition now to the fascinating world of corporate governance, immense personal wealth, and shifting American culture.
And we begin with the really insightful story of Charlie Munger's final years. Munger died 2 years ago, just shy of his 100th birthday. What's striking is his deliberate choice of environment.
He prioritized stimulation over luxury. He insisted on staying in his longtime Los Angeles home, which notably lacked air conditioning, rather than his spectacular Montecito mansion.
Why?
He wanted to be close to his intellectual companions and his engaging business projects. This just reflects his lifelong philosophy. Intellectual curiosity and companionship are the ultimate wealth, not material comfort.
And that dedication to purpose led to some truly gutsy, unconventional bets in his final years.
Oh, absolutely. Often defying the standard investment consensus or even his own past practices.
Like getting back into coal.
His foray back into the coal industry is legendary. He had shunned coal for 60 years, but in 2023, he saw that while the industry was in long-term decline, many producers were trading at extremely inexpensive levels, yet remained profitable in the near term.
So he jumped in.
He jumped in, buying shares of Consol Energy and Alpha Metallurgical Resources, and scored paper gains of over $50 million. He famously dismissed the consensus that coal was a dead sector as, quote, horse feathers.
That's textbook Munger. Having the patience and confidence to see value where others just see decline. And his other late life wager was in real estate.
A colossal real estate play. Starting around 2017, he backed two young neighbors in Afton Properties to buy Southern California garden apartments. They purchased nearly 10,000 of them, now valued around $3 billion.
And he insisted on a unique long-term debt strategy.
He did. While others were using short-term debt, he demanded they secure favorable long-term interest rates and hold the assets for decades. He understood that in real estate, time and manageable debt are the ultimate competitive advantage. His final real estate transaction purchasing a building across from a Costco closed just days after his death.
Incredible dedication. And beyond finance, the sources give us these intimate glimpses into his personal life. He faced near blindness around 2014.
And he took the setback in stride, contemplating learning Braille. He adjusted by having others read to him. His famous breakfast club meetings were crucial for keeping his mind sharp and for companionship.
And his diet.
His diet was wonderfully lowbrow. He embraced comfort foods like Korean fried chicken, Costco hot dogs, and Spam fried rice, a throwback to his army days. It's just a blueprint for aging with purpose and intellectual engagement.
Now we shift abruptly to the darker side of immense wealth and the individuals who facilitate it, the accountant and lawyer for Jeffrey Epstein's fortune.
Richard Kahn and Darren Indyke. They worked for Epstein for decades and now serve as co-executors of his estate.
And this narrative provides crucial insight into how Epstein operated.
He was not a rogue individual. He was the head of a well-oiled machine sustained by professional enablers. Kahn and Indyke provided the sophisticated legal and financial backbone needed to mask his activities. They continue to deny knowing about his crimes, but the record of their actions is specific and damning.
Let's pause on these details because they illustrate an intentional cover-up.
Okay, consider Kahn, the accountant. He authored a letter to U.S. immigration officials endorsing a very healthy marriage that was a complete sham. It was used solely to secure U.S. papers for an Eastern European woman Epstein was abusing. That's active complicity.
And Indyke, the lawyer, specialized in systematically masking financial footprints.
This detail is just striking. Indyke made systematic cash withdrawals of exactly $7,500 about twice a month for 4 years from Deutsche Bank.
Why that specific number?
Because the federal government mandates reporting of cash transactions over $10,000. This was a clear, intentional strategy of structuring withdrawals to fly beneath the regulatory radar. They also helped Epstein open new accounts after banks like JP Morgan and HSBC finally cut him off.
And their incentive was immense.
Oh, they were paid millions. They received millions more in loans that were never repaid, plus perks like covering their children's education.
And now they're co-executors of his $100 million-plus dollar estate.
Right. They control access to evidence, to assets, and are even beneficiaries of the 1953 trust, potentially receiving tens of millions. And they initially tried to use their position to immunize themselves.
How?
By requiring victims who settle to sign a release barring them from suing Kahn and Indyke personally. That's why victims have pressed the House Oversight Committee to investigate the men who are essentially gatekeeping access to evidence. It's a powerful story that underscores how complex financial misconduct requires these ostensibly legitimate professionals.
Shifted to corporate drama, Lululemon is dealing with a major identity crisis.
And it's being driven by its estranged founder, Chip Wilson, who is publicly attacking the current CEO, Galvin McDonald.
Wilson still has an 8% stake, which gives him a loud platform.
It does, and he's blaming McDonald for a loss of cool and a lack of innovation, comparing Lululemon to the Gap with cheap acrylic sweaters.
The stakes are enormous. The stock has fallen over 50% this year,
wiping out over $25 billion in market value. Shoppers are flocking to trendier rivals like Aloe Yoga and Vuori. This is a classic case of post-founder syndrome, where the visionary believes the growth achieved by the operational leader has diluted the soul of the brand.
And McDonald's defense.
He defends his tenure by pointing to a nominal growth sales have tripled since 2018 under his watch, and a strategic focus on core areas like running, golf, and yoga.
But Wilson's point is about quality and brand relevance.
Right. He cites issues like the poorly received breeze-through leggings as evidence the company is prioritizing finance over technical innovation. McDonald did admit that parts of their product offering had become predictable, so he recognizes the need for renewal. The question for Lululemon is whether they can transition from a cult brand into a diversified athletic giant without losing that technical edge.
While the corporate elite are battling over technical wear, the rest of America is adapting to economic pressure through what has been delightfully dubbed the leftover Olympics.
It's a perfect cultural marker of inflation. It reflects this profound, forced cultural shift away from America's history of high food waste.
We're seeing things like fridge foraging, bone bags for broth.
And my personal favorite, pizza eggs. Leftover pizza cut up, crisped, and mixed into scrambled eggs.
And this isn't just a low-income trend.
No, not at all. A Mizuho survey found a record 49% of respondents reported eating more leftovers than 6 months ago. Even high-income consumers, earning over $200,000 annually, showed a 4% increase in leftover usage since July.
That data point is critical.
It is. It shows that inflation has become so rampant that it's forcing consumption changes across all income brackets. Even corporations are tapping into it. Kraft Heinz sold a limited-time leftover gravy in a squeezable bottle for Thanksgiving.
A sign of the times. And finally, a unique success story in global finance, Wall Street's brother act.
Fernando and Osman Rivera recently promoted to co-heads of Latin America for Goldman Sachs.
And this is remarkable, not just for their joint success, but for their background.
Exactly. They grew up in Honduras and achieved partner status, overseeing Goldman's massive push into Latin American investment banking. They attribute their comfort with financial volatility to their upbringing in a region often lacking political and socioeconomic stability.
And they seem to represent a perfect synergy of professional skills.
A completely complementary force. Fernando is the detail-oriented expert, masterful at navigating country complexities and legal risks. Osman is the macro expert, focusing on geopolitics. For example, Osman was an early internal voice predicting the significant spike in U.S. inflation during the 2020 pandemic.
So they're a powerful team.
A very powerful team. They've overseen massive financing deals, like $3 billion for Colombian toll roads. Their success just proves that diverse backgrounds and experience in high-volatility environments are becoming highly prized assets in global finance.
Okay, to wrap up our deep dive, let's look at two areas that require some immediate attention: year-end tax planning and the state of major global sports. The mega bill passed last summer included significant tax law tweaks that demand action from affluent Americans.
They really do.
The first major change is the highly discussed SALT deduction state and local taxes, currently capped at $10,000.
And that limit is being raised substantially to $40,000 starting in 2025 through 2029. This is a massive win for residents in high-tax states. It reverses the trend we've seen since 2017 and will dramatically expand the number of filers who choose to itemize.
So for planners right now, the strategic question is, should itemizers prepay 2026 property taxes to boost their 2025 deductions?
That requires caution. You have to ensure that the taxes are formally assessed and due, not just an estimate. But for those in high-tax states, the increased deduction limit makes itemizing far more valuable moving forward.
And we also have crucial changes coming to charitable giving, effective in 2026, which impacts year-end giving strategies for this year.
Right. There are two main groups impacted. First, non-itemizers will, starting in 2026, be able to deduct a small amount up to $1,000 or $2,000 for joint filers and cash donations.
Which is a big deal for charities.
Huge. So for non-itemizers, the strategy is simple. Delay any planned cash gifts for 2025 until January 2026 to ensure they capture that new deduction benefit.
And for high-income itemizers, the strategy is the opposite. Accelerate gifts into this year. Why the urgency?
Because the top tax rate they benefit from is scheduled to drop from 37% to 35% starting in 2026. This means a charitable deduction taken in 2026 will be worth 5% less than a deduction taken this year.
So for large donors, the key strategy is to accelerate substantial gifts into donor-advised funds, or DAFs, this year.
Exactly. Think of a DAF as your personal charitable savings account. You make an irrevocable contribution to the fund this year, securing the large tax deduction immediately at that higher 37% rate. The money then grows tax-free, and you can take years or even decades to distribute the funds to your favorite charities.
So you lock in the highest possible tax benefit before the rates fall next year.
That's the move.
Okay, tax planning complexity never sleeps. Finally, let's wrap up with the latest in the sports world, showing this contrast between catastrophic failure and unconventional success. We start with Liverpool's stunning collapse.
It is truly one of the most shocking spirals in decades of Premier League football. Liverpool was cruising to a championship last spring and immediately embarked on a $500 million spending spree, intending to launch a dynasty.
And instead?
Instead, they have lost 9 of their past 12 games and are currently sitting 12th in the Premier League.
What specifically caused the wheels to come off so dramatically?
The primary failure is the total evaporation of their attack. They are producing barely a third of the shots per game compared to last season. Their record signings are just disastrously underperforming.
Don't Florian Wirtz and Alexander Isak?
Wirtz, the German playmaker signed for $156 million, has 0 goals and only 2 assists in 15 games. Isak, a $165 million striker, is struggling to score. Combine that with aging stars, like a 33-year-old Mohamed Salah slowing down, and you have a team that is disjointed and devoid of confidence.
On the other side of the sporting coin, the San Francisco Giants made an entirely unconventional hire, appointing Tony Vitello as manager.
A direct challenge to baseball orthodoxy. It is an unprecedented leap. Vitello jumped directly from college baseball, having led the University of Tennessee to the College World Series title in 2024, straight to the MLB dugout.
With zero prior professional baseball experience.
Zero. As a player, coach, or scout.
Why would a major league team bypass the traditional minor league grinding route for someone entirely outside the professional structure?
This is driven entirely by analytically minded front offices who are challenging the old ways. They are prioritizing a proven winner with high octane leadership skills and a modern successful program over the traditional requirement for minor league dues. The hire signals that MLB is fully embracing the analytical revolution. His success or failure will be watched across the industry as a definitive test case for this approach.
That brings us to the close of our deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, November 29th, 2025. We've synthesized a huge amount of material today, from the unexpected market euphoria and the surprising fragility of the data centers that support it, to the intense geopolitical and defense technology setbacks plaguing global stability.
We've examined policy shifts driven by tragic events, the intersection of immense wealth and enabling greed in the Epstein saga, and the cultural shift toward leftover Olympics driven by basic economics.
And across every story we've explored, the Simi data center overheating, the drone boats failing at Anduril, or even the inquiry into the Boeing 787 crash where pilot intentionality was questioned, we see a fascinating and troubling pattern.
We do. We are increasingly dependent on these sophisticated automated systems that require perfect execution, flawless engineering, and continuous physical cooling to ensure global safety and stability.
Yet the human element, intentionality, error, reckless greed, or political short-sightedness remains the most unpredictable and difficult thing to engineer out of modern life.
Exactly. Even as our technology becomes exponentially more complex, the profoundly messy human element, the deliberate action of an enabler like Epstein's lawyer, the reckless acceleration of a defense contractor, or the political motivation of a leader seeking power is what ultimately dictates market stability, national security, and even the safety of our physical infrastructure. That variable, the human intent, is the one constant that always, always defies the algorithm.